Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. At this year's election, the Nick Xenophon team emerged as the third force in South Australian politics, luring voters away from both major parties. In this parliament, where the government needs every vote it can get in the upper house, Xenophon and his two colleagues in the Senate, Stirling Griff and Skye Kokoschke-Moore, are especially important players. To many listeners outside South Australia, their names may be unfamiliar. But whenever Labor and the Greens combine to block a piece of legislation in this term of Parliament, the government will have to come knocking on their doors to ask for their support. The two senators join us today. Stirling and Skye, before entering Parliament, you both had roles working behind the scenes for Nick Xenophon, one as a staffer, the other as a campaign manager. How have you found the transition to being elected members in your own right?
Oh, well, I've certainly really enjoyed the process. I've had the benefit of being around Nick for nearly 6 years now, so I understand the way that he operates, but even
frenetically.
Frenetically, yes. Yes, that's for sure. But I suppose even, or just as importantly, understanding the way that the Senate works, it is so rule-driven and so procedure-driven that I have a great deal of sympathy for people coming into this who have had no exposure at all to the inner workings of Senate procedure. So that's been a big help for me.
I'm really pleased to hear you say you have a lot of sympathy for someone that has had no no background in this area.
So you find the hustings more congenial,
look,
do you?
Look, a huge learning curve, and I'm following behind Skye like she's the mother hen, and I imagine I'll be doing that really for another few more weeks, but very appreciative that Skye is there.
Now, there's a very diverse lot of senators on the crossbench these days. How are you going in reaching out to them, indeed reaching out to Labor and government as well?
Look, I think diversity is a fantastic thing, and I'm really quite excited about this this Senate. I know there are a lot of people that are particularly on the Liberal side of things. I think they're feeling a little bit uptight, perhaps. But look, I think it's a great combination of people, and we've found, and certainly I've found, that it's really quite collegiate in the Senate.
Skye, have you reached out at all to the Hansonites?
I wouldn't say I've reached out. I mean, just touching on the comment
coffee?
I made earlier. No coffees.
No coffees.
But I'm the Nick Xenophon team whip, so that means I'm responsible for making sure I've got Nick Xenophon team bodies in the chamber when I need them to be for votes, and also just in terms of organising the party in One Nation, their whip, Brian Burston, I spoke to him in the first few weeks just to say, hey, listen, I know that this will be completely new to you. If I can give you a hand understanding any of the procedure and the organisational things, let me know. And the reason I did that is because a Senate that functions well and functions properly functions in the best interests of Australians. So having people caught offside because they just don't quite understand how it works, I don't think that's a good outcome for anybody.
Now, in the lower house this week, all the talk is industrial relations. Those bills, which were the double dissolution triggers, will take a while to reach the Senate. But how do you think they'll go when they do? The government seems to be fairly optimistic.
I suppose it's the government would like to be optimistic about it, and with any piece of legislation, the Nick Xenophon team will work constructively, hear both sides of the argument. I know, for instance, with the ABCC previously, and it is still the case now, that Nick and the team are looking for some amendments, particularly in relation to the building code and requiring building projects to the greatest extent possible to use Australian goods and services. So we'll be looking at the bills closely, but we'll also be keeping an open mind to amendments.
What do you think about the Lionhelm play to get some concession on gun laws in return for his support of the ABCC bill?
That sort of horse trading is very dangerous.
They're not related, and you know, we don't.
You think that's out of court, that he shouldn't be acting like that?
Absolutely.
Do you think that Malcolm Turnbull should have been more decisive today in just saying not on, rather than saying, oh well, we I don't want to engage in that sort of talk publicly.
Look, from a government point of view, I mean, he needs the numbers, so that's why he's playing that game. Ideally, he wouldn't be in that position if he had more people in there, but I can understand on his side why he does need to get involved in that kind of horse trading.
It's fairly damaging, though, isn't it? Because at the end of the day, the government is not likely to sign up to that sort of concession.
Well, he wouldn't think so, and I think ultimately it would be damaging for them at the next poll. So it's not something that we would do.
Do you believe, either of you, in any sort of horse trading that is outside the particular piece of legislation that trades off something quite other for support for a piece of legislation?
No, not at all. There's a line that Nick uses quite often about when you're horse trading, you can end up with a donkey or even worse, make an ass of yourself. Mm. And I think that's a philosophy that the whole team is behind.
I mean, you've always got to be true to your core, right? Your core beliefs, you have to be true to that.
Now, the same-sex marriage legislation will soon be before the Senate. Your team has said that it won't have a bar of the plebiscite. Is there anything at all that the government could do with this plebiscite, any way it could alter it, put different conditions on it, that might draw you into talks passing it?
I think agree to a free vote in Parliament right now.
That would be the only
condition that we would support.
What sort of feedback are you getting in the electorate on this issue?
We're certainly getting a lot of feedback from constituents who are concerned about the impact a plebiscite would have on them, on their children, on the mental health of their children. Sterling and I both met with Rainbow Families a few weeks ago, and the children who visited us spoke so eloquently and so beautifully about the devastating impact a plebiscite would have on them. And I only wish the standard of the public debate around this would match that these young children were able to bring to us. It was just, it really drove the message home that a plebiscite can do so much harm, especially to the young.
Do you think that opinions changed in the last few months on the plebiscite? Because it was people were quite strongly in favour, and now the polls seem rather different. Did you pick up that transition in opinion?
I think public opinion has changed over the last 3 to 5 years, I think, on this particular topic. And I don't think there has been much of a change with the plebiscite. I think the people that were supportive, once they thought about it a little more and realised that it wasn't going to be binding in any form, understand that really it is a huge waste of money and quite divisive.
But you wouldn't be interested in it even if it was binding?
No, not at all. It should be a free vote in the Parliament.
Another issue that's come to the fore this week is the situation on Nauru, where we've had Amnesty report, we've had Four Corners. What's your feeling about what really the government now can realistically do to deal with what's now become an embarrassment to Australia overseas and an appalling issue in itself?
I think the most awful thing about detention has been the lack of hope that the detainees have about ever being resettled anywhere. There's no doubt the government has to come up with a plan that sees refugees who are owed protection resettled in a third country where they will be safe. This lack of hope is absolutely deplorable.
And do you think that there is a realistic way of getting a third country, for example, to take these people?
Well, I think it's the government's responsibility to work towards that. They put asylum seekers there. It's now their responsibility to help find a solution about where they should go now.
But it's turned out to be quite difficult in practice. Presumably, if they could find a country, they would do it.
They shouldn't give up. They shouldn't give up.
The racial discrimination legislation has also reared its head again this week, with calls on the Liberal side once again for the amendment of that legislation. Now, you're against any amendment, but when you see a situation like the bill leak cartoon, which was quite brutal in its depiction of some Aboriginal people. Do you think it is appropriate that action can be taken under that legislation, or do you think, even if you totally disagree with that depiction, that questions of free speech are at issue?
Look, I don't think whether it be a drawing, whether it be speech, whether it be standing up and abusing people, I don't think we should tolerate any. I don't think we should have any changes to the Act. In fact, I think where it sits now is quite valid, quite a valid place for it to be.
So, in that case, do you think that there should be able to be action against a cartoonist for something like that under that legislation?
Yes.
So you'd like to see him
dealt with? I would not have a problem with that, no.
Is there any free speech question here?
Well, I think if a person makes a statement or distributes an image which people take offence to, that and a complaint is submitted, that complaint needs to be adjudicated, and yep. It's not up to me to say whether or not that it's offensive. It needs to be adjudicated. So,
One of the big issues that you'll be watching at the moment is the stoush between the first and second law officer about how legal advice should be obtained, whether it should have to go through Senator Brandis, the Attorney General, or whether it ought to be able to go straight to the Solicitor General. What do you make of this argument? We've seen fairly torrid scenes before a Senate committee, and the two men seem to be really having a great deal of difficulty in being able to work together in this area. What do you make of it?
Well, I think one of the core functions of the Senate is being a house of review and being able to shine a light on issues that might not otherwise get to be explored. What we're seeing now is just that happening in practice. In terms of the actual issue that's in question, it seems that a convention has developed over the years whereby heads of departments would approach the Solicitor General for advice, and it seems that there was some attempt to clear up that particular practice, but we'll see what the Senate Committee report hands down when they table their report shortly.
Do either of you have an opinion on who's right and who's wrong in this argument?
No.
No. No, not really. But as Sky said, it has been the convention that people are able to go straight to the Solicitor General for advice, and really that's the way I believe it should continue.
Well, if Senator Brandis is right, then that might need a change in the law, because he maintains that just going through the Attorney General is the way the law should be read. So would you favour, if necessary, a change in the law to go back to the old situation?
Well, if the old situation has worked very effectively, as it has over many years, there'd be every reason to consider that.
Apart from that, there'll certainly be a motion in the Senate to go back to the old system, of everyone being able to go direct to the Solicitor General. Would the Nick Xenophon team vote for that motion?
We'll discuss it as a group, and we'll wait to see what the Senate committee reports.
But it does flow from what you're saying, that you'd be likely to be inclined to vote for it.
I think we'll be looking at what the Senate committee report comes up with and the evidence that's been received. The most important thing is that there is a resolution to this, one way or the other, whereby it is crystal clear on the part of the Solicitor General who and how he or she in the future receives instructions from heads of departments. That's the issue that must be resolved.
Do you think these two can continue in harness together over the long term, however this works out?
Well, that comes down to both of them, doesn't it, really? I mean, it's up to the two people to be in one room and hopefully reach some form of resolution.
Maybe you should put in Nick Xenophon as a mediator.
Whoa.
That's pretty...
That would make it very interesting.
It would.
Very interesting.
Can I just finish off on just something about the future of the Nick Xenophon team? It is such a party centred around one person and one person's popularity. How do you see it evolving? Do you see it as a long-run party, and how would it move to that situation? And secondly, although you're so different, there is an overlap with the Hanson Party in a sense that both of you tap into people's feeling of discontent and alienation. How do you see that competition going in the future?
I don't think we're tapping into discontent and alienation. I think it's to a certain extent, yes, there would be a little discontent. I think more frustration, I think, with the other parties, in that they have in the case of the Liberal Party, it's moved quite a way away. You know, it's becoming more a right wing party than what it was in the past. In our case, we're into fairness. Fairness would be our core. Yes. Our values are the same as Nick's values, and it's quite a challenge to be able to have a significant number of additional candidates that are going to follow, you know, in that same direction. But, you know, we're not looking to have, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 candidates in the next parliament at all. This is a very much a evolutionary kind of party.
But can it evolve beyond Nick Xenophon?
Well, it's evolving already. There are four of us. You know, Nick was one out of one member of parliament. Now there's four.
And he'll be the first to say it, and we agree that we do need a name change. So if anybody has any suggestions...
Oh, no, don't say that.
We're open to suggestions.
Last time that happened, we had hundreds of people sending us emails and calling us on the phone, so please don't say
that. But no, we're mindful of the fact that, yes, we are identified through Nick, and the name of the party reflects that, but because we are here for the long haul, we recognise that a name change will come into play.
In time.
Thank you both for coming and talking with the conversation today. And that's all from our podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back with you again soon. I'm Michelle Grattan. Goodbye for now.